Dave, thank you.
All right, first order of business is to thank everyone up here for their time and effort to put together a really outstanding set of presentations that demonstrates a lot of good work that these people have done. Just a round of applause right away for that. And again, it's worth acknowledging Gary's efforts over the last 23 years to kind of make this happen. 23 years ago, Gary had the idea that concepts about Western weather were somewhat underrepresented by government agencies, and there was a need to talk about things that were rather unique to California. And so I think with that seed, a lot of things have happened over the last 20 years or 23 years now, and to see something like the Center for Western Weather and Water Extremes, I think, is extraordinary and a real affirmation of the initial vision that you had 23 years ago. So thank you, Gary. Since David Ford taught me all about word clouds at the start of the day, I thought it was appropriate for the word cloud in my head to pop out atmospheric rivers. What is an atmospheric river? Mike, I'll let you dive into that. I know you've done some work on definition for that.
I'm trying to remember the official one. Don't have it memorized. But basically, I mean, we've heard it several times, and I think Ben might have actually given the closest thing to a formal definition. John talked about detection characteristics. But basically, yeah, it's a, oh boy, we fought long and hard over this word. I'm going to use the word that we jettisoned. It's a long pathway, a long narrow corridor of strong, I think is the word we ended up with, strong vapor transport. Typically, the core is a kilometer or two above the surface, although, as Ben showed, we have to be cognizant of transports above that. They're anywhere from 2,000, well, they're generally, unless they're 2,000 kilometers or long, we toss them out and don't call them ARs. Historically, we've described them as being on the order of 500 kilometers or more wide. And there's a variety of either how much precipitable water they have along them or how much vapor transport they have along them that actually gets defined different ways by different people. I'll just say they're really at the heart of the atmospheric arm of the water cycle. This is something that I think we don't pay enough attention to. They're of great practical importance. They're also, they conduct somewhat on the order of 90% of all the vapor transport outside the tropics occurs within ARs. And, you know, they're the machinery for moving water around outside the tropics in the atmosphere. And one of the consequences of that is as the water cycle changes with climate change, The atmospheric rivers, it's where the rubber's going to hit the road. They are very important in that context.
Good. So, Jonathan, you also had talked about atmospheric rivers quite a bit and had a really neat gridded map showing kind of a heat map of atmospheric rivers. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that you had talked about kind of the threshold that you were looking at was only like a three-hour window where certain characteristics met. Is that a different definition of ARs, or how does that create, or how do we prevent confusion if it's talked about it slightly differently?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. I think that, so I used there are certain geometric criteria, which I used in my analysis, which are that the AR has to be at least 2,000 kilometers in length, and personally, I don't typically worry about the width too much, but many definitions will say something along the lines of less than 1,000 kilometers or around 500 kilometers in width. The one thing that the question was about is the duration criteria for defining the atmospheric river. People have different lengths or durations that they use for it to qualify as sort of an AR. What I was actually showing in terms of ARs would maybe more accurately be described as AR conditions being realized in the reanalysis instantaneously at one reanalysis observation. And in the reanalysis I use, these observations are taken every 3 hours or so. So you could have some very short ARs in there that are only 3, 6, 9 hours long. Whereas many of the traditional analyses will look for an AR that's lasting more on the order of 24 hours or so.
Great, thank you. All the questions shouldn't come from me as a moderator up here, so kind of the rules we're going to play by, if anybody has a question, raise your hand to contribute a thought or ask a question of anybody in the panel. Gary's going to have an eagle eye out and keep track of who's raising their hands and follow up. So we got one right here. Thank you.
Thanks. Great job on all the presentations. Those were really informative today. And I want to go on the record as saying I don't believe that ARs are evil, Michelle. So, sorry. So we've had lots of presentations over the years and lots of descriptions of ARs and their frequency and characteristics and value. But I've yet to find a hydrologic model that uses an AR as input. So my interest is in how are we taking what we're learning about ARs through our monitoring efforts and our studies on climatology and everything else, and how are we integrating that into numerical weather prediction models that can resolve the temperature and precipitation time series then that we can integrate into hydrologic models and provide warnings and services.
Anybody have courage enough to dive into that? All right, Mike, thank you.
Courage or stupidity, we'll find out. Actually, you have the great divide. I think that we're still trying to find a way to connect to a certain extent. A lot of this work came from observations and enabled the moisture transport element of it to run on ahead and race ahead and develop some element of a life of its own. But John kind of pointed out, you can look at an analysis of AR activity, but when you look at that precip anomaly, they don't overlap. And that's part of trying to figure out how moisture converts to precip and how that moves in. And to some extent, that part of where I said chewing on the temperature element and how that feeds into that process as well. It's a lot of work left to be done and probably needs a louder drumbeat for it.
I'll add a little bit to that as well. To properly resolve, you need models of a certain scale that can identify the thin filaments of moisture moving through the atmosphere and how that gets transferred to the soil or the snowpack. So models like VIC, which are coupled to the grids in the general circulation models, are one avenue, I think, going forward where you can have a resolution of a hydrologic model that matches the resolution of the weather forecasting model, if you will, get it down to WRF, for example, or West WRF, that was talked about today. So then you can kind of get a direct connection, but I think what Michael says is that there's still a lot of work to be done yet to make that happen. National Water Model is another channel where that process could be identified. John, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I was just going to comment on a few efforts that I know of that are at least underway trying to get at that connection between the AR studies and better numerical weather prediction. One of them is Jim Doyle, I think is the name at Monterey, is doing some work where he shows that these relatively thin filaments within the atmospheric rivers, getting the sort of the temperature and the moisture profile of these regions within the ARs right is very crucial because these tend to have the models, if you run them forward 24, 48 hours, are most sensitive to these regions of activity within the ARs, regions of heat and moisture transport. And I know during the Cal Water field campaigns a few years ago, there were a number of offshore observations taken across ARs, parallel to along ARs. And a number of these observations made their way into some numerical weather models, at least the GFS, some runs of the GFS. And I know at NSEP right now, they do have some people working on a project where they're doing sort of a data denial experiment where they run the models with those observations and run the models without those observations and trying to see how much of a difference that makes in the forecast model skill in predicting precipitation out to a few days. So hopefully there's some ground that can be covered in that direction, but I do think one of the keys in terms of AR research and getting it into operations and better precipitation forecasts is just understanding where we get the most bang for our buck in terms of numerical weather prediction. And so I think those are a couple efforts getting at that.
All right, one other little thing to follow on, and this comes from a conversation with Robin Webb and the great rapid response to El Nino, where they thought, boy, they'll hit that void in the Eastern Pacific with a lot of data, and boy, the models will do better, except when they didn't. And it was interesting because the models are tuned to the data that they got built with, and new data until the models trained to accept the new data, the model tends, if its initialized state is far enough away from that observation, it'll discount the observation to the point that it doesn't matter whether it's there or not. And he brought that up as, well, this is something we really have to pay attention to and not short-circuit ourselves into thinking, well, hey, we'll do these experiments and it'll either show whether it's of value or not. And he said sometimes if you don't look at that base conceptualization, you might be throwing out something that has value that you just currently don't have the capacity to set up.
So we had a lot of good talks about this year and what occurred, and we got lots of good observations of this 2017 water year. However, there weren't really any talks, maybe one hint where we need to look at the longer-term sub-seasonal factors, because we haven't really discussed why we had so many anomalous atmospheric rivers that were clustered together that produced the impacts. Now, as a meteorologist forecasting these events, I noticed that there was the pattern tended to repeat this year. It started in December, and it happened again in January and even February, where we had a blocking high-pressure ridge that developed across the higher latitudes, which was followed by a troughing in that same area and a strong jet. Now, a lot of these big AR years have occurred under a weak La Nina or cool, neutral, ENSO base state, and I noticed that this year, especially, there was a lack of convection in the tropics along the dateline, and a lot of anomalous convection over the maritime continent. Do you guys have any feel, early indications that some of this repeating pattern happened to play a role down there in the tropics, that really what happened this year was kind of more of a something that happened down in those tropical areas due to the tropical forcing, or was it more something else?
First off, as I think it might have been John who said, you know, basically you're going to have to stay tuned for what I'm sure will be half a dozen, you know, amazing but probably contradictory explanations for what happened this year, or why it happened, I should say. I will note, you put your finger right on it in a sort of observational sense, that we have typically seen these sort of setups in those years where the tropics are cool to near normal, and you know, where everything kind of shuts off in the tropics is at least part of the story historically, and we certainly saw that kind of thing going on today. I do know that in some of the sub-seasonal to seasonal attempts to forecast AR frequencies, how many there are, you know, months ahead, a month or so ahead, a a lot of the activity is up over, basically over the Aleutians, so that there's more to the story than the tropics, I think, in this case, but stay tuned.
Have another question?
Yeah,
you each seem to be in agreement that the atmospheric river storms are showing themselves in a lot bigger way. And it seems to me that that is a major game changer as far as how we conduct ourselves, certainly in California. Are you having conversations these days, more conversations with the powers that be, in other words, the politicians and others, to both design and build water infrastructures that would optimize the availability during these brief periods when we know that maybe right around the corner we'll be sitting high and dry? I'd like to hear some of those conversations.
Any takers?
I'll just toss in and remind us of the FIRO talks. You know, that's all based on the notion that maybe we can, maybe before we start building new things, we should think about managing what we have a little bit more, well, taking advantage of what we've learned in the past 30 to 50 years in terms of forecasting and the like. It's kind of a cop-out, but.
All right, let's get the other end of the table involved a little bit. The National Weather Service. For the last several years, I have to give kudos to the National Weather Service for their use of social media and the infographics that they put out, because I think that is a huge, huge step forward in communicating impacts and confidence and risk to the public for what you have. So with the experience now that you've had with social media, what are some of the lessons that you've learned, and what are some of the unintended consequences of social media?
So the benefit to social media, and actually Nina asked me who our graphic artist is in the office, and we actually make all of those products in-house. The meteorologists have done it, and really the inspiration is the partner interaction that we have. So when we started making these infographics, we put the stuff up there that we like to look at. High and low pressure systems, cold fronts, jet streams, and we're like, look how pretty this is. We'd send it out to the public, and an emergency manager would call me and say, so what does it mean to me? Is it gonna rain? Is it not gonna rain? Do I need to prepare for wind? What does any of this mean? And so we started having more and more conversations, and realized we need to start making pictures for our friends and family. We have to stop entertaining ourselves, because that's what we like to do, and entertain the public we're here to serve. So it was through the interaction with partner relationships. And somebody asked me earlier about the, you know, how are we handling the folks that haven't caught up with the technology age? That's another place that these partners are helping us, because we know we can't do it alone. We try, trust me, we try, but we know we can't. But we have partners out there who are beating the same drum. We're all singing off the same sheet of music, so we're all saying the same thing. So no matter how they get it, whether it be through the media, through their emergency manager, through NPR, they're all hearing the same message. The probably biggest lesson learned with social media is it's not an emergency-driven thing. You can't stand up a Facebook page in the middle of an Oroville incident and expect everyone to follow you, because they don't know you. It's a social thing. So it's actually the quiet times that you are putting out information constantly, and the stat of the day, or hey, did you know, or here's an interesting fact, and you build that community before the emergency comes. Because that way, not only are our partners the force multipliers as far as messaging, but the community is. That's where that relationship building has come in the most benefit. It's when those one post will reach 500,000 people because their friends are posting to their friend's page, hey, did you see this? You might want to alter your trans to Tahoe. All this stuff, and that's nothing we did. It was something that we built a connection with that person, and now they connected it to another person. So it's you know, that matrix, I can't remember what it is, but you tell one person, they tell two, they tell four, and it was, you know, the drop in the bucket. The disadvantage to social media, all I'm going to say is chemtrails. you do open the door to trolls. I'm not going to lie about that. We do have regulations, because we are a federal government, that if they post anything or are promoting anything, we have license to remove their post. But for the most part, 90% of the time, our fans or our followers will take care of them for us. We don't have to get in there and start a fight, because they're going to jump in for us and say, you know what, we love these guys. If you don't like them, unlike them. It's not a big deal. Just get off the page. So, but there are the occasional trolls who like to get in there and just pick a fight. So we do our best to monitor that, but I think the benefit is way outweighed the consequences.
Okay, excellent. Any feedback from the audience on social media? Like, how many people are on Facebook in general? What, how many? Okay. How many have liked their local National Weather Service office? Or follow on Twitter, either one. How many are going to go home today and like their local National Weather Service office or follow on Twitter? I encourage you to do it, because it's really, really good. It's worthwhile. Okay, I'm not going to let you off the hook. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Dr. Crawford.
The question of, you know, whether the weather coming is going to affect your plans for the weekend, what, you know, driving into the mountains, is certainly an important question for the general population. There is a something of a dilemma problem. And I won't speak exactly about the Tuolumne, but let's say you have River George, and there's a reservoir on River George, and you happen to know, as would have been true this summer, that in 3 days, River George is going to go release 100,000 CFS and will flood out 20,000 people. What do you do with that information? There's a probability attached to it. If the risk of flooding 20,000 people in 3 days is 10%, do you make that public or not? I think so far that isn't made public. But this is really a question for you. And you know, just where there we do have now, and we'll have even more in the future, this kind of information affecting a lot of people, and what do you do with it?
That's a really good question, and we've got a number of actual operators in the room. I mean, Mendocino, what do you guys do in terms of risk?
No, I gotta hold it. Okay. So we actually don't operate for flood control. We operate for water supply, but certainly there is risk for water supply, especially with the drought. I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I'm not really a public information person, certainly we were constantly messaging out to the public to conserve water, and especially agriculture, because they are a large water user in the watershed. And then as well, I mean, for my role, we were preparing, it seemed like, water supply forecasts, seemed like every month. And that type of information was provided to our public information people, and they would disseminate it usually in a way that was digestible by the public. Yeah, so we don't really do, I would say, a risk analysis where we're doing sort of an ensemble of evaluations for water supply. We tend to, we have our methods, and they're more, I guess, deterministic, but it is something that we are constantly doing. But I think when it comes down to FIRO, I think that is a challenge, though, especially if you get into an approach sort of like what I developed. I mean, I've heard people comment that, you know, when you're evaluating an ensemble of outcomes, and you have an outcome that's saying, well, gosh, look, this could happen. I mean, because we're saying that those ensembles are equally probable. Why aren't you managing to the most extreme forecast? And I think that's something that the whole FIRO process is really going to have to work through, because it'll have to be a messaging and how you you know, talk to the public about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to kind of address Dr. Crawford's point about telling the public that there's that 10% risk, technically we already have. I mean, Rob Hartman can speak to the ensemble forecasts that are actually on the public website for the California Nevada River Forecast Center. Now, they may not always connect the dots between that ensemble member and flooding 20,000 people. That hasn't been done directly publicly yet, but the information framework is certainly there to do that. But it's an interesting question to how to manage that information once it gets out to the public. Kind of on a personal basis, I tend to like to push more information out than not. I think that we tend to, I've had a number of examples over my career where I think engineers as a profession, and probably meteorologists and scientists in general, underestimate the intelligence of the general public to handle information. The example I use all the time, the weather radar stuff that you see on TV, yellow and red and blue and green and all that kind of stuff, when that first hit the airwaves, there was some resistance from the meteorology community that said, the audience isn't trained to interpret that. Well, how long did it take everybody to figure out if that big red blob was heading toward your house? It was going to rain really hard in a few minutes. Okay, they got it. And so there's a number of different examples out there. And so I'm coming from the side of things to get that information out to the public and continue to educate how to deal with it. So anyway, anybody else? What do we got?
I was just going to make a quick comment. We just had a wonderful mass experiment in working with the public on your 1% chance, which is the evacuation of Yuba City and Marysville. So, you know, the other half of it is that would be a wonderful thing to do some post-analysis on communication, risk communication, how many people moved out of their house for what they may have said was nothing. But at the same time, we have to do that. So, you know, I do think that we have found a way to at least say we're not going to allow the public to be at, you know, at these extreme events.
Go ahead.
Changing threads. It's okay.
I was wondering if there's an estimation for the recurrence interval of flows on the main stem of the Sacramento River and the San Joaquin River for the recent 2017 storms.
Oh, we have a taker down there. Go ahead. Yeah. These are flows, the river flows, not the rainfall.
Right, exactly. Okay. That's exactly what I was going to say. I'm sure there are. That was sort of out of the realm of our work. So I don't know if anybody else has more direct knowledge of that. But I'm also not sure what the correlation is between, you know, the recurrence of precipitation versus the recurrence of a flood, because that's very basin dependent, depends on what fraction fell as snow versus rain, that sort of thing. A very specific question somebody else would have to address, I think.
David or Nathan, do you guys want to stick your toe in that water? Let Nathan do it. There we go. MD?
Who wants to take a stab at this? All right, no, we haven't gotten quite to that yet. It will come in time. We do know for different, in terms of the amount of water coming out in a water year total, we're right up there at the top of the historical record. Still have to wait to get to the end of September to get everything logged into the books, go through the data, and then try and figure out all the nuances of what flowed down the mountain through the reservoirs and how that all fits together before we get all that put together. So good times ahead for sure. Some engineers.
It does also occur to me, the USGS does have frequency statistics at their gauges, so that would probably be the best place for data to work that out.
This is potentially a new thread, but it's one of the purposes of the symposium is to perhaps educate ourselves and ask ourselves to perhaps face questions that perhaps are a little bit outside of the comfort of scientists. And one of them is, I think, the presentations on Mendocino, on operations. There's been a fair amount of legislation that's been proposed that asks the Corps of Engineers to find ways to squeeze more water out of reservoirs that they have flood control manuals with. And the question then becomes, in a world that may face more extreme floods in the future, is that really the question or the challenge that forecast-influenced operations should be charged with? Or is it really the charge of forecast-influenced operations to find a way to do better with regard to water supply as well as flood control? And I did notice in the Mendocino presentation that there was at least one time in which the proposed operations or your test operations actually put the reservoir below the flood control reservation. And that's certainly one test of whether or not there might be circumstances where you may improve flood safety as opposed to just doing no harm, which I noticed was one of the presentations. So I'd offer the question to folks here and also offer the question to the audience to the extent that they talk to elected officials or prepare testimony in front of august bodies about whether the only objective of forecast-influenced operations should be a water supply component.
Actually, I think that the forecast-informed reservoir operations is being looked at for flood control every bit as much as it is for water supply improvement. I've looked at some of the reports that have been done, looking at all the pros and reasons why you want to do forecast-informed reservoir operations. If you look at the cons of why you don't want to do it, I kind of sum them up generally by saying it's hard. It's really hard to do. and because of the balancing of the risks that you have, if most of our reservoir operators, there are a few that are single purpose, but most of them are multiple purpose reservoirs. If you're trying to figure out how much water to release in advance of a storm, quite often you're releasing water out of what's known as the conservation pool. Out here in the West, somebody owns that. So you're releasing somebody else's money. That's what you're doing. And that's hard to do, because if you don't refill, then how does that risk get managed? And does somebody pay for it?
You're out of a job
first.
What's that? You're out of a job.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you look at, really, we don't have to look back too much further than 1997, when in January 5th, about every reservoir in the state was chock full of water, and they immediately started dumping, and we had a couple of the driest months on record, January and February, and some of those reservoirs never refilled. You know, and there was a lot of hard questions being asked at that time, and that's part of the risk assessment that we're making. Ron, did you want to follow up?
In some cases, the reservoir operator is the same operator who has responsibility for flood control, in the sense of it may be their community downstream. So in those circumstances, the operator certainly has the option of doing better, as in making a pre-release, even though the Corps manual doesn't require it. DWR did that with Oroville in 97. Began to make releases, flood releases, on the basis of forecasts, I think quite responsibly. But I guess my question continues to be the interest on the part of Congress that appears to be rather one-sided. And so I agree with you that in the academic world, we think about, forecast influenced operations can do both. And that, I would argue, is the right way to think about it. My concern is that isn't always the way that decision makers are putting the challenge in front of us.
I think one of the issues in terms of, again, forecast informed reservoir operations is that conditions for using that approach changed throughout the country. For example, forecast operations in Texas, where you're dealing with short-lived thunderstorms, where your QPF is not very skillful. So it's hard for those guys to basically take that unskillful QPF, dump a bunch of water in the hopes that maybe that thunderstorm curved over to their watershed instead of the next one over. Out here, we're still trying to basically identify where and when the atmospheric rivers, is it going to hit the Feather, or is it going to hit the San Joaquin, or is it going to hit the Yuba? Which ones are going to hit? And it affects how these decisions are being made. Snowpack. Okay, snowpack is a different time scale quite often, and how you're dealing with that. That comes into play. Multiple reservoir systems. Largely in California, we have a lot of individual rivers feeding the Central Valley, but in individual tributaries, there may be only one or two reservoirs, where in some of the major reservoirs that are operated in the center part of the United States, there are multiple, there are systems of reservoirs that have to be effectively controlled. And if you look at all of California, we have a kind of similar problem here. So there are a lot of complicating factors, but with that, even saying that, I think there's a lot of places where there's some low-hanging fruit. For example, if you're in a reservoir that encroached on flood control space in the middle of our flood season, core regulations, most of them will say you got to get rid of the water in 10 days to get down to the conservation pool. We rarely get blindsided by a storm in our 10-day QPFs. A QPF of no rain over the next 10 days is pretty reliable. Okay? So why not wait a day? Rather than start dumping the water right away, wait a day and see what the next 10 look like. Before you know it, you're probably going to use your natural releases or in-stream flow requirements to get rid of the water naturally, and you don't have to get rid of it unnecessarily.
I don't think any of us are objecting to
forecast influenced operations for conditional storage into the flood pool, which is what you're talking about, where it's appropriate. You know, you're close enough to the ocean to be able to make a release without burdening others downstream. I think the more difficult issue that may in some cases be being cut off is whether or not the benefits of the forecast operations may include digging down into the conservation pool. And you know, to some degree, the Corps does have some leverage if it chooses to use it in saying, well, you know, we'll give you the authority to do conditional release, but in some circumstances, we want you to pull the plug on the reservoir and dig down in the conservation pool a little earlier. And that's the kind of dialogue that in a world where we may have more extreme precipitation, we may want to have more flood control performance out of the infrastructure we have. And so that's the kind of conversations that I think are appropriate and we should be having.
Anybody have anything else to add on? Okay, Maury.
This is something different, so if you want to stay in the topic.
Oh, perfect, good. Time to change.
Okay, this is a very mundane question, but it's not too often that we have an august panel like we have now that can render their advice. The Northern Sierra eight-station average has been mentioned, and the annual average there is 50 inches, which was developed in the 80s when the index was set up. If we were to do it today, the logical thing to do would be to take the 65 through 2015 average, which is about 52 inches. But a lot of people have gotten used to that number. And so I just wonder what your advice is on these averages that we have in the indexes as they change through time.
Hey, Mike?
Yeah, I'll chime in. Kind of fits my role, a state climatologist. Alrighty, so one of the things I think, Maury, that really you want to look at it is the use of the index and the value that it provides. And the sense that we use the eight-station index for kind of a sense of the Sacramento Basin wetness. And, you know, I've done different running averages of the eight-station index, and sure enough, you see kind of decadal scale variability plus or minus 10-12% sometimes. I'm not sure we've quite figured out what to do with that information. So I'm not sure. I like having the 50 as the anchoring point that we can work with. You can look at that subset of time and you say, hey, we're in a wetter window. But until we figure out a little more about that wet and dry decadal scale evolution, we might not want to get too excited about pushing it up or down the way some have argued for. Because I think that the 50 is a good anchor point of which we set our expectations and give us a sense of just how weird the given year is. You have the additional information of, well, this is an unusually wet year within a wet string of years that are wetter than given relative to other time periods. And I think maybe layering it like that might be more valuable than just changing that average up every so often.
Question for our folks from MetStat. In your talk on the frequency and return periods for the things that happened this past year, you had a couple of interesting graphs that showed higher return periods in the rain shadow portions of the region. Why?
I think that's a great question. I think that would merit more detailed analysis on the individual events. I believe it was Ben's talk that highlighted this is the year with no rain shadow. And I think that's an interesting idea. I think, you know, he showed pretty conclusively that there was a tendency for ARs to have higher moisture transport at higher levels of the atmosphere. So to me, it seems conceivable that there were just a series of these events wherein more moisture made it over the coastal range than usually does, and therefore fell in the valley.
Yeah, I thought your guys' results on that were really cool, because that's, you know, a nice statistical way to show kind of what I was discussing in my presentation, but to actually have some data to show that is always really cool to say, oh, this is what we think is happening, and well, there it is. So that's kind of interesting. And so blending the two analyses could be kind of interesting, because using, I guess you could even do the kind of analysis that you guys did for different years to identify years where return intervals were very high in rain shadow, characteristically rain shadowed areas, and then you could go backwards and do kind of the analysis I did to try to figure out, okay, were those test the hypothesis, were those characterized by elevated moisture transport in sort of the middle troposphere, the middle portion of the atmosphere, or was there another process going on, like what John showed, where he had his, you know, typical trajectory of an atmospheric river, and then he had these other arrows, which I think were the agiotrophic circulations. Is that? That's what I was interpreting those as. So part of, basically those are, that's one reason for the circulation being sort of not quite orthogonal, but somewhat orthogonal to that main corridor of moisture transport, and that could offer another way to get moisture around terrain, so it doesn't have to necessarily go over the terrain, but it can also go around the terrain, and that could be another hypothesis that could be tested, or most likely is, as with most things in science, oh, it's a combination of all of the above. E was always my favorite test question answer. So yeah, I thought that analysis was really cool and kind of sets us up to look at some of these things in a slightly different perspective, because a lot of the rain shadowed regions are the most water limited, and this is one thing I always kind of mention, this is speaking sort of more globally, I always tell the students, you know, we can learn all these cool things in California, but you know, California, yes, it's the center of the universe, but there's this whole other world, 42% of which is dryland environments, and many of those environments are extremely water limited, and they have very little data. Try to apply the work that you do and learn in these data-rich areas to these data-sparse areas, because that can benefit a lot of people. So that's just sort of a little soapbox to end that.
Yeah. The symposium last year, I think it was last year, I believed Dr. Ralph presented a paper or a presentation that he showed that when during the formation, when you get good orthogonal flow against the Sierras, you get a low-level barrier jet that forms and the AR actually rides up and over it. How could that have played into this year, since we did have an awful lot of events with a strong level of jet? I mean, could that be an explanation?
Yeah, so what's interesting about that result is so I have a student who basically tested that this year, and so we got interested in, I think it's a figure from a Paul Niemann 2013 paper, it's probably where that came from, and you see the atmospheric river riding up over the barrier jet, and so some of Jessica Lundquist's work has shown that during the presence of the barrier jet, you dramatically can increase the orographic precipitation gradient, or maybe I have that backwards, you decrease the orographic precipitation gradient, and you get a lot of rainout, orographic depletion, upstream of the Sierra Nevada, and part of the formation of the barrier jet is you get a very stable upstream structure and you get a very strong mountain wave, and when you have that very strong mountain wave, that contributes to a lot of descent on the lee side of the mountain and precipitation inhibition. So it actually turns out that when you have a very strong barrier jet, not only are you transporting water northward into kind of the headwaters of the Sacramento River Basin, but you actually end up with a very strong rain shadow effect. And looking at this on a sort of hourly time scale, what's been really interesting is that as the barrier jet breaks down, that gives you about a 3-hour window to forecast the onset of spillover precipitation, because that implies that the breakdown of the stability on the upstream side of the Sierra, so the windward side of the Sierra, is now going to allow more moisture transport to move over the Sierra, and it's also going to shift the structure of the mountain waves such that you have ascent on the lee side, and that'll also contribute to precipitation enhancement in the rain-shadowed side.
Back to the Weather Service. You refined my idea of what the warning meteorologist or warning coordination meteorologist does, but you said something I thought was pretty interesting, is that you're kind of also coordinating amongst all of the offices that cover California. How do forecasts end up being different in these areas where there's some overlap or where the forecast areas butt up against each other?
Ego. As scientists, we all want to have the right answer, right? Even if my answer is a little different than yours, this is my area, so I'm going to put my answer in my area. So that is a challenge we continue to face, but I do believe with this new approach that the Weather Service is taking, one of them is embracing something called the National Blend of Models. And it is showing some incredible promise. The West, of course, was the last area they tackled because, obviously, the West is the hardest to forecast. And modeling, especially, because of all the microclimates and whatnot. So I think you'll start to see better consistency as we move down that road. Let's face it, the models, thanks to the research that you guys have all done, we can't beat them anymore. We really can't. So it really is just a matter of us trying to make our mark in the grids, but that's not the future of the Weather Service anymore. To go back to Dr. Crawford's comment about when do we tell them there's a risk. And we always have this mantra in our office, tell them what you know when you know it. And the emergency managers have told me, I'd rather have you tell me there's a small chance of a big risk 7 days in advance than for you to sit on it for 5 days and only give me 2 days to prepare. So we do lean very forward with those partner emails. And we tried to get fancy with it first. Oh, we're just going to share it with the emergency managers. Well, then the public works people were like, well, we need to know that information too. Caltrans is like, we need to know that information too. So we've actually put in our partner emails, there's a potential for a high impact event, but our confidence is low. Please continue to follow us, follow the forecast and whatnot. There isn't a perfect answer. The best quote I ever heard from an emergency manager was, I don't need the right answer. I need the best answer you have right now. Because they have a multitude of decisions to make, and weather is just one piece of that. 90% of the time it's driving their decision, whether it be Caltrans canceling everyone's holiday leave because a storm is coming, or there's a storm coming on the weekend and they know their traffic's going to be bad. There's just all of these pieces, and as scientists in general, we all have this dilemma. We love our numbers. We love the right answer. We want to be right 100% of the time. But who are we right for? Are we right for us, or are we right for the users at the end? And I think that's a big dilemma with you guys talking about the forecast-influenced reservoir operations. We saw this with Oroville. You know, as it was happening, everyone's like, well, it might be this, and it might be that, and it might be this. I just need your best answer. Just give me your best guess right now. I'm not going to be mad at you if you're wrong, but I need to give them some kind of information. And the information was there's a potential for it to fail, so the warning went out. And yes, some people would argue it went out for nothing, but what if? What if it had retrograded? What if that auxiliary spillway had caved and we sat on it because, well, we weren't 100% confident? So we always, as our agency leans forward, public safety is our number one priority. So that's why we tell you what we know when we know it. And yeah, we're gonna be wrong sometimes, but the public is amazingly forgiving. And so is our emergency management community, but that's because we've built the trust. It's not just us throwing stuff out and saying, well, sorry, we messed up. You know, we come back and we explain. Or if the storm looks like it's backing off, we tell them that. We put out a partner email that says, guess what? It's looking weaker. You can stand down. So it's just a matter of, like I mentioned at the end of the presentation, it's constant communication. You can't just put something out there and then sit back and go, well, maybe I'll tell them when it comes or not. You know, it's just, that's, we've unfortunately built a society where 140 characters is the way to get your news. And if you can't tell them in 140 characters, they're not going to listen, because that's the attention span of our public right now.
Good, thank you.
Yep.
I think we have another question here.
We have a nice diversity of folks up here, and coming from different backgrounds in operational and research. And I'm wondering if there were any key aha moments this year, or things that happened during this wet year that will change what you do going forward, or, you know, or on the other hand, if this was just a chance to put into practice and observe some of the things you've been researching or preparing for in flood management. So, yeah.
Nice question. Okay, we could just about go down the line here and offer some input. You want to start off, Mike?
Heck, I thought you'd start at the other end. Anyway. Any aha moments? Well, this year led to a number of new experiences for me in terms of who I was doing briefings to. I think I told my boss at one point, I'm now swimming in the deep end, and he reminded me there are no lifeguards up there. I was excited for the standpoint that we were going to have the opportunity to collect a wealth of data that we probably wouldn't truly fully digest for quite a while, but we have the opportunity to collect it and see where that takes us with that new knowledge. That's probably my biggest woohoo moment, I guess, out of all this.
What he said? So, I don't know quite how to say this because it's going to sound really obnoxious, but I've spent a lot of time in the last in recent years looking really hard at how droughts get busted. And prior to that, I was working on arc storm and a lot of these things that simply weren't looking so great in the context of this four or five year major drought that we were in. There was no single storm that was going to bust us out of this drought. A lot of things like that. This year actually kind of gave me a lot of confidence that if something really does make sense, that even if people say, that'll never happen, keep saying it, because boy, this year, you know, between busting droughts and arc storm and all that stuff, it's like a lot of old friends that I had worked on that seemed pretty academic at the time started looking like they made a lot more sense after this year.
John?
No big real aha moments, I guess, but it was just sort of a cool experience because I began my graduate work on atmospheric rivers right after the winter of 2010 and 2011, which was the last sort of big significant year for these sorts of events, at least in the southern half of the western United States. And as soon as I got going working on it, they didn't happen anymore. So it was really cool to start to see the a little more activity this year and have it be really sort of exciting again. That was fun.
Yeah, for me this year was really super exciting because normally my experience in graduate school was the minute you plan a field campaign, that's when you can expect none of the weather that you want during the entire period. So this year, having it planned for January through March and going up and being able to sample some of these really incredible storms was fantastic. And then also to have started at Scripps with the motivation for FIRO primarily coming from this water supply issue. And then as you were mentioning, now we can sort of illustrate how it can be also used and to further reduce flood risk. It has been really exciting in terms of talking to the community members who live in that watershed. I don't know any answers for you about who's talked to Congress about that, or even I don't know that that is a regulated thing or just a maybe Chris can speak a little more to that. But anyway, it was great to see that kind of back to back with the super severe drought and then this year to just see what use we can make out of the existing infrastructure we have if we're not going to get resources to do anything else as the climate changes. We might expect more of these drastic swings to come.
Yeah, so kind of along the lines of what John was saying, so working with this snow level radar data set, it's been really nice to actually have a year where you had more than like 20 hours of precipitation in the whole year, so you could actually see some dots and they move around a little bit. So that was really cool. But then from our paleo work and being interested in a lot of these terminal lakes, which we saw fill up this year, that gives us a lot of really cool data to test some hypotheses, not just to how do we get the lakes, but also for some of these basins where nobody lives, nobody's pulling water out of any of the streams, that some of which are still flowing. But how long do these lakes last? And so you can almost use them sort of as natural evaporation pans, and you can couple those with some groundwater models to try to better calibrate your models to try to reconstruct, you know, how long do these lakes persist? Because that gives us the other question or answer to the question of the effect of moisture. You know, you have your precipitation, but then you also need to figure out your evapotranspiration, your evaporation from the lake surface to really know that you have it nailed down. And so now we have probably enough data from just this year to be excited for the next 5 or 10 at least to keep us interested and keep us busy. So it's been a good year for lots of data.
So I guess in the FIRO world, it was really exciting to do the virtual test that we did. It's one thing to analyze something in a historical perspective, but to actually do it in real time this year was really exciting, and I think it was sort of an aha that possibly FIRO could be feasible, at least for Lake Mendocino, if not for other reservoir systems. You know, in other locations. So that was really exciting.
So I guess my aha moment would be the motivation for our study in the first place. Working in an industry where we're attempting to give precipitation data to hydrologists and dam safety officials for them to make decisions, and the industry standard is really where you're expected to get this information in chunks of like 72 hours, whether it be for probable maximum precipitation purposes. And then seeing an event like this year where that's completely outside of that realm, and how do you deal with that information, how do you pass that information on, and subsequently what are they going to do with that data? So still kind of struggling with that, but just knowing that that's now out there, that's now something that we should be investigating further.
Yeah, building off what Victoria said, for me it comes down to the motivation for this project, which was the Orville Dam crisis this year. That sort of motivated our whole probe into what's the character of this wet season like, and what sort of circumstances can lead to something like that, which was a great experience for me, because as somebody who's new to the, you know, whole hydrology, dam safety sort of industry, it was interesting from the standpoint of it made it tangible. You know, it gave my work sort of a clarity and purpose that I hadn't had the opportunity to see before. So that was great.
How to say it's going to be wet again 100 times this winter. It was very exciting for us to really delve into the whole decision support services and be able to tap into all the new resources that we were test bedding. So the, you know, we still have some folks on our staff who think social media is evil and we shouldn't use it, but they are by far a minority and they even do it. They'll never sign their name, they'll never, you know, we all know who does it, but it's really cool to see an organization like mine, and I love it, I've been here 23 years, but to really see us moving in a time that we need to be and in a place we're moving to. This winter, I've been here 4 years, so people accuse me of bringing the drought, which I didn't do. But to really see my office, the CNRC, DWR, all working in tandem to get a consistent message out, it was a beautiful thing to witness and be part of.
And I know Dr. Crawford's been taking notes down here, so he's probably loaded for bear. Go for it.
The there was a comment made in your paper, or you made a comment, that consideration of a sequence of storms was not a standard way to think about the way a reservoir could be, the safety of a reservoir would be considered. And that strikes me as true. If I had given in to my devil instinct, I would have asked you, why do you think that sequences of storms have never been considered? And the answer is, hydrology, for many of us, especially those of us who have some gray in our heads, prior to the computer era, was the art of picking certain bits out of the continuous behavior of a system and then making your dam design or your safe yield from a reservoir or whatever else you wanted to know out of a fraction of the continuous record. And the main innovation that came out of Stanford in the 60s was we wrote a whole series of papers about continuous simulation, which meant setting up a watershed and trying out how a dam or how facilities would behave over 80 years or 90 years or whatever, and then further creating, you know, 1,000 years or 10,000 years of generated precipitation, generated weather, and then running that through the physical facilities. But again, looking at the system continuously instead of just in bits. It's a tendency in engineering try to make things that are inherently chaotic into something more better behaved, like trying to make your children not be children. And so my experience in running or in looking at the current year was, first of all, to recognize how difficult a reservoir manager's job is when they actually have to open gates or make decisions about how to run a major resource with, you know, all sorts of economic and human consequences to the decisions that are made. And they make these decisions in a very uncertain environment. I'm losing track of my train of thoughts, which usually means you should stop speaking. So, in fact, I guess I will.
All right, thank you. And we have one more? Okay, we're done. All right, thank you very much for that last question, because it was a perfect setup to get everybody engaged and some thought-provoking ideas and answers, so thank you.